slides and a lot of things to read and some videos, so I want to make sure everyone can see them. So thank you very much for coming. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Paul Steen, and you probably know me best because my children are featured prominently on the Ann Arbor Christian website.
So, how much did you pay for that?
Yeah. Where's my royalty rights? The stars of the show always in my eyes. I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I've been coming to the church for a long time. I'm the son of a CRC pastor, so I've been attending CRC churches my whole life, usually twice a day, you know, until recently. And that's a big part of who I am. I'm also an environmentalist. I spend over half of my waking hours, basically, at my job, which is the Huron River Watershed Council. That's a nonprofit on Main Street in Ann Arbor. Our job is to take care of the Huron River, but also take care of the land that drains to the Huron River, because every little bit of water that falls on that broader watershed affects the water quality of the river. So the environment is it's a really important thing to me. This talk today is a really personal thing for me, because as a Christian and as an environmentalist, I see so many Christians who are not that way. And it ranges a spectrum from people who probably care about the creation but don't really do anything about it, to people who are Christians yet antagonistic to creation. So I see, just in my everyday life as I go about and listen to the news, I see all that and it distresses me. So I put a lot of work into this presentation, kind of trying to pull these reasons out and try to understand it better. I'm certainly not an expert at the topic. If you wanted to hear what I'm really good at, I talked to you about aquatic insects for multiple hours, okay? So I'm kind of a layperson on this particular topic of environmental stewardship. And certainly then what I want to do is, my goal here is to show you that being an environmentalist is biblical, and then how can we take that and then put it to something that's a practical application. And I picked plastics, because that's also been high in my mind recently. So to accomplish this goal, I'm actually going to step back a little bit into the historical record. This is all before I was born, so I'm going as an academic and not as someone who's experienced to this. So people, my hope is that it's long enough ago that no one here actually remembers it, so I can say whatever I need to say. In the 60s and in the 70s is when our country really started thinking environmentally. Several things happened that put us in that direction. Silent Spring is a book by Rachel Carson, in which she talks about how she goes outside and she doesn't hear the birds anymore and what happened to the birds. And it's a really interesting narrative of her explorations into pesticides and the thinning of bird shells and what happened to the birds. And that really got people thinking along lines that they've never thought before. And after that, we just have a whole slew of things that are happening. The Clean Air Act gets put into place, which is regulating what's coming out of smokestacks. There's an article written called The Tragedy of the Commons, basically saying, take an unregulated resource, put a whole bunch of people who can access it, and that resource is going to become depleted. Example of this, and one we see in Michigan, from about 1830 to 1890, fishermen first came into the area, settled Michigan, along with everyone else. But they fished out 1.2 billion pounds of whitefish from the Great Lakes. And since then, the whitefish has never really recovered. It's there, but it's not in its numbers that it was before. So that would be an example of the tragedy commons. What happens when a bunch of people all take just a little bit more than what they should? The Cuyahoga River fire. So at this point, and this isn't the only one that has happened on, actually the River Rouge flowing through Detroit set on fire a couple times. So we have rivers that are catching on fire because all kinds of stuff, pollutants are being dumped into the rivers from industry, from sanitary sewers. All of this stuff is eventually formulating into the formation of the US EPA, the Clean Water Act, which was co-authored by Representative Dingell from Michigan. We have the Endangered Species Act. So all this stuff is happening in the 60s and 70s, kind of setting the trajectory for where we are today. But in the midst of all this, how this comes back to Christianity, in the midst of all of this, there's an article written in the journal Science, which is the journal in the field that everyone reads, saying that Christians are at fault for all of this. The author, Lynn White, is a historian. He blames the Judeo-Christian tradition for using Genesis 1:28 dominion mandate as a license to abuse creation. So that verse reads, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish and the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. So this word rule is actually like very strong. I don't know Hebrew, but from what I read, that's a very strong word in Hebrew also. And yes, I mean, it's giving the word strongly in the Bible that we are to rule. So as all things, taking one specific verse out of the Bible and using that because it appeals to you the most is always a dangerous thing. Just looking at that and ignoring the rest of the context of the Bible is problematic. But that's kind of how we got to this point. Lynn White says, especially in its Western form, Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has ever seen. So Christianity is putting humans at the center. Our science and technology have grown out of Christian attitudes towards man's relation to nature, which are almost universally held by Christians. So initially I was pretty opposed to I really disliked the conclusions here. But no, that's not true. Christianity is not responsible. The guy makes a very good argument though. Further contemplation and then reading some of the materials that I'm gonna mention in a little bit, another way of, maybe his eventual conclusion is misguided. I think what we have is Western culture and the Industrial Revolution as the tools that maybe led to the environmental crisis, but it was this dominion mandate kind of philosophy behind it. Doesn't mean it was Christianity itself responsible for the ecological crisis, but Christendom, like that culture that has taken up Christianity, which oftentimes is more misguided than guided. So it's not necessarily the Bible that resulted in this, but this cultural influence. However, certainly it is the case, just taking this to modern times, we still see many, many Christians with an anti-environmentalist bent. So here's just some of the things that I've heard in modern times that account for that. For one, people say caring for creation is secondary to leading others to belief in Christ, so we shouldn't be wasting our time because this is our primary focus. People say environmental problems are just a political agenda to put Democrats in power. Absolutely, I mean, I hear that all the time. And then it's really interesting how you treat creation is very much related to your view of the end world, or how the world is going to end. So premillennial eschatology, this is the belief that believers, at the end of the world, believers are raptured up into heaven when Jesus comes back. the world is put through this great tribulation, and all this bad stuff happens to everyone who's remaining. So we're not going to be here when the world ends, so why do we really care what happens to the world? It's kind of what that mentality brings you to, which is shown very well in the book The Left Behind series, which I read all of those, and it's a fun read, but the theology is just something I can't agree with. Ultimately, then, you're saying this world isn't our home, really. Jesus will come back and take us away before things get too bad, so why do we care what really happens on earth? And then you can go to the more extreme view, which I definitely also heard people say, well, let's let the world burn so that will force Jesus to come back quicker. You know, people actually say this as if we can manipulate the return. Right? So this all kind of comes from this concept of premillennial eschatology, and it leads Christians into not caring about the environment. When I was in college, I worked for a professor who was running a research project, and she interviewed seminary students at Grand Rapids Theological Seminary in Cornerstone, and then she interviewed students at Calvin Seminary, and my job was to transcribe all the interviews, and she also had them draw pictures that graphed their understanding of the relationships between God, humans, and creation. And from Cornerstone, without a doubt, this, like the vast majority, this is what we would see. And this will make more sense in a minute when I compare that with the Calvin Seminary philosophies. But basically, God is over humanity. Humanity is over creation, and it's very clean cut. So, in the context, just to go back to that White article, in the context of Christianity being blamed for the environmental crisis, which, you know, the argument had some merit. Swooping in to the rescue, basically, we have Reformed scholars. So, in 1980, this book was released. This is really like the watershed book for the Christian environmental stewardship concept from the Calvin Center for Christian Scholarship at Calvin College. A bunch of Reformed scholars got together and said, this is what people are saying about Christianity. Whether it's true or not probably doesn't really even matter as much as we need to respond to this and guide people in how they should be thinking about creation. So they took a more holistic view of the Bible rather than just looking at that dominion mandate. One verse that really comes very quickly after that dominion mandate is this one. The Lord God took the man and settled him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and take care of it, Genesis 2:15. So the idea that we are here to take care of the garden of creation. And from this book, two really important key words came out that we, at least one of them is well known, so the idea of stewardship, how we interact with the environment should be in a stewardship manner, and then the word earth keeping. As the Creator keeps and sustains us, so we must keep and sustain the Creator's creation. So, to contrast that with the other slide I had on eschatology, what we have from the Reformed perspective, creation, fall, redemption, creation has fallen, but creation is being redeemed through Jesus' work. And in terms of our eschatology, this world is our home. So this is where God put us, and this is where we belong. The understanding this world has actually already been saved. We are waiting for the final fulfillment of Christ's promises when God will make his dwelling on earth, and the gap between heaven and earth will be no more. And Pastor Ryan gave me that lingo so I could get it right. But yeah, this world is our home. There isn't some far off heaven that is our real home. This is our home. We will not sit back and watch this home burn. We are going to do what we can now. And this is what speaks to me. Like this is part of the reason that I love the Christian Reformed Church. This is what my dad preached to me all those years when I was sitting in front of him, and it's what our pastors do the same here. And it's one of the reasons that we come here. So there's also the contemporary testimony, Our World Belongs to God, from the Christian Reformed Church. Made in God's image to live in loving communion with our Maker, we are appointed earth keepers and caretakers to tend the earth, enjoy it, and love our neighbors. God uses our skills for the unfolding and well-being of his world so that creation and all who live in it may flourish. So we see this word earth keepers, which comes from that 1980s book. They were using it directly from that. And then to go back to that graph, so going to the Calvin Seminary students, the vast majority of students were doing this. We have God, and then God is over creation. So you can see the difference in here. And humanity is part of creation. Humanity is not, essentially the relationship would be God is the God of humanity, humanity is the God of creation. I mean, that's kind of what this gets at. Not the case here. Humanity is part of creation. We need to interact with creation in such a way that we're not calling ourselves gods of it. Other traditions see this too. St. Francis of Assisi said all kinds of interesting things about the environment. We have a quote from Pope Benedict saying we need to pay attention to climate change. And then a great quote from Mr. Rogers. Turns out Mr. Rogers is Reformed. But once I saw a quote from Mr. Rogers, I had to put it in there. If you were a fish, you wouldn't want somebody dumping garbage into your home. Every fish is fancy in one way or another. There's something fancy about every creature in the world. Each person, each fish, each animal, each bird, each living creature. So he just has a way of always saying things so clearly. I want to go back to highlight one other Reformed scholar who was a part of that earthkeeping book and then went on to do many other things. Calvin DeWitt, he wrote a lot of stuff, but in particular this ecology and ethics paper that he wrote, he had about 7 biblical principles where he's really thinking about earthkeeping in a way that I had never seen before. One of those is the Sabbath principle, the idea that Sabbath is not just for humans, it's for all of creation. And we need rest to rejuvenate and restore. Sabbath provides limits. It shows us that we're not supposed to go 7/7 of the way, all the time. No, we're supposed to go 6/7 of the way. There's a limit. There's a limit built in to the biblical teaching that affects how we interact with the land. In the biblical teaching, it also says, I'll just read this to make sure I get it right. In the 7th year, the land is to have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Failure to keep these and other ordinances will result in the people being driven off the land. And once cleared of its disobedient people, the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbath, getting the rest it did not have during the Sabbaths you lived on it. So Sabbath principle is setting limits upon us with our relationship with the land. This is the other principle that I really liked from Calvin DeWitt. We should enjoy but not destroy creation's fruitfulness. So God actually gave the fish and the birds a mandate during creation. He said, be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the water in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth. So he told that to the humans, but he also told that to the animals. If we are actively preventing these creatures from fulfilling their mandate, we're getting in the way of God's direction to them. So that's the idea of the fruitfulness principle. I mean, and then we were absolutely, in terms of fisheries, I mean, our fisheries are a mess in this world. We absolutely are getting in the way of fish being fruitful and producing. One of the problems we just don't know how much fish are out there, so they try to regulate it, but it's a moving target, so you never quite get it right. And so ultimately, like, our fisheries have just collapsed, you know, worldwide. Cal DeWitt went on to help found the Ensemble Institute. So this is in Mansellona, Michigan. It's meant to be a training ground for, they teach all these ecology classes to undergraduates. I went there for an interim at Calvin, and it really affected how I am. It not only are they teaching the science, but they're also showing you how to live. So I wanted to point that out. It's a really special place.
Where is that?
Mansellona, Michigan's like near Grayling. So it's northern Michigan. Yeah. And the conversation continues. I want to start talking about plastic, but after that 1980 book, you know, the world has changed, and the conversation continues in the field for how Christians should be interacting with creation. There's a brand new book called Beyond Stewardship, written by all the new professors at Calvin College and partners. And they're starting to say things like, well, maybe we should stop saying the word stewardship. When people hear the word stewardship in church, they think money. You know, let's come up with, for the future, let's come up with different words that we can use to best explain what's going on. Let's talk about environmental kinship. And earthkeeping. Earthkeeping is still a term no one has stolen. Let's use earthkeeping and stay away from that stewardship. So the idea of that, what I'm trying to say here, is just people are still thinking about this stuff. We're trying to fit Christian environmental stewardship or earthkeeping into today's world, and that's an ongoing effort. So from there, you can talk about all kinds of things. How should Christians think about climate change? How should Christians manage their lawns? How should Christians think about big land use issues like mining, strip mining? How should Christians think about endangered species and habitat degradation and destruction across the world? So what I want to talk about is plastic, which has been kind of top of my mind recently as different things have happened. They stopped picking up recycling every week at my house a couple years ago. I was like, that's weird. What's going on with that? So I was curious. I started hearing all this stuff about microplastics, and it turns out the Huron River has like the highest microplastic concentration across the Great Lakes. So I was like, what's going on with the Huron River? That's actually my job, so I need to get a handle on that. So I've just been thinking a lot about plastics recently. So that's what we're going to talk about. And of course, you can't talk about plastics without this. All right, the plastics were the future, right? Here's some plastic fast facts. I'm on the wrong slide here. I can't talk about fast facts unless I actually have the, here we go. So yeah, I was curious, what are people finding out there in nature in terms of plastics? Kelly and I and family have spent the last several summers or a week or so at Lake Michigan, and I've just been seeing more and more plastic on the beach, like more than ever than I've noticed before. And I'm at the same time, I'm like, well, is that because I'm more aware and thinking about it, or is there actually more? I'm not sure. But in terms of beach cleanups, I look to see what was found most often. You have cigarettes, food wrappers, plastic beverage bottles, plastic bags and straws. Those are, if you search online, what are found in beach cleanups, those, in some manner, sometimes higher or lower, you find those five things all the time. from this book, which is a British book, so this has got a British perspective. It's reported that less than half of the 35 million plastic bottles that British people throw away every year are recycled. Over 90% of seabirds are estimated to have plastic in their guts. 120 billion plastic bottles are made by Coca-Cola every year, and the majority of those won't be recycled. And then it takes 450 years for a plastic bottle to break down in the ocean. In terms of health effects, there's so many, I'm not going to go into all of them, but BPA is something you've probably all heard about. That's bisphenol A. It's an endocrine disrupting chemical associated with a host of human health problems. And BPA leaches from your plastic bottle into your water, and so then we're drinking that. And that happens especially when temperatures get high. So you may have heard it saying, well, don't drink water from your bottle if you like leave it in the car during the summer and it gets all hot. That's because chemicals are leaching into the water. But something to think about is that you can control, because you know your car. We can't control how all of these things are stored and transported. Who knows where these crates of plastic bottles were sitting before they got to you. They could have been in a really hot warehouse. You just don't know. So it's just a health concern there. Another thing that has become more and more clear to me over time, and this is when I started thinking about it, when they stopped picking up recycling as much as my, at my house, it's just not as good as you think it is. It has certainly been sold to us as the cure. But if you look into how much recycled plastic is actually recycled, it ranges somewhere between 10 and 25% of actually what we're putting into our recycling bins is making it to the recycling yards. A lot of it ends up getting burned. Most of it is shipped overseas. So recycling, and actually we have a whole thing about it. I'm going to show you in a little bit. A nice little video that kind of encapsulates that and makes it very understandable. What actually tends to get recycled is aluminum, glass, and paper get recycled very well. I think like 90% or something like that. Like the technology is more clear and there's more direct secondary use of those recycled materials. It's technologically more simple. When you talk about plastic, there's just thousands of different kinds of plastics, but like need to be recycled with like, so that you might have an odd plastic that gets thrown away. The stuff that tends to get recycled are your number ones. Your number ones are your polyethylene, that's water bottles. The problem is a lot of those don't make it into the recycling bin. Number twos tend to be recycled a lot. Those are your semi-clear, high-density polyethylenes, milk jugs. So milk jugs tend to get recycled. And then the number fives, so one, twos, and fives. Number fives are polypropylene, and that's stuff like salad dressing bottles or ketchup bottles. So they say now that you can throw all your, no matter what the number is, you can put it in your recycling bin, but I think the reality is a lot of that then gets thrown away at the back end. On my way out of church last week, Chris Adams sticks his head out the window and was like, you have to watch Broken, it's so good. I'm like, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And he was right, it was amazing. It's a Netflix episode that talks about all this stuff. And I actually want to show a little clip of that, and it's because it's starting to get at environmental justice issues, which are really interesting to me. So I got like a 4-minute clip of Netflix here. Hopefully it runs on church internet.
10,000 communities in the U.S. alone had established collection programs. A full-blown recycling...
Sorry, you're jumping into the middle of things. We'll start making sense. The
U.S. plastics industry is investing more than $1.2 billion in plastics recycling.
It also began to catch on in other countries around the world, where collection and recycling of plastics became the norm. But soon, it actually became easier and cheaper for the developed world to sell that plastic to one country. China.
China has been the biggest place for recycling of scrap plastics.
China had everything the plastics recycling industry needed. A huge industrial infrastructure, a massive low-wage workforce, and a robust shipping industry that could cheaply import containers of plastic scrap from all over the globe. Also, recycled plastic was cheaper than buying new.
If one used scrap plastic recycled material, they can save a lot of money.
The rest of the world was thrilled to get rid of their plastic garbage and make a little money doing it.
China said, we will take all of these low-grade materials from you so you don't have to handle them anymore, and we'll pay you a pretty good price for them.
Thousands of recycling plants sprung up across China, processing millions of tons of plastic every year.
They were running around the globe, buying up every single scrap of plastic that they could get their hands on. So for 20 years, they expanded their infrastructure, and all of our industrial nations' internal infrastructure for recycling was undermined as a result.
By 2017, China was buying nearly 3/4 of the world's plastic scrap.
我本身是叫葉凱，從事塑膠行業有已經有20年嘅年頭啦，有塑鐵廠啦，有大明廠，分間工場，把啲所有個裡面好雜嘅東西分清，分得一清二楚，分翻級別，再生利用，又分出嚟打好包裝，再嚟處理啊。
Lots of recyclers, the main objective is to find the most efficient way to recycle. But this most efficient way doesn't mean this is the most environmental way.
Many Chinese recyclers were disposing of their excess waste by burning it, which was causing massive air pollution.
With the start of the Summer Olympics in Beijing less than 3 weeks away, Chinese officials began an aggressive new effort to reduce pollution.
The Olympics in China really drove home the environmental issues associated with industrial growth in China. It wasn't just, you know, the world seeing it, but it was their own citizens seeing just how bad air pollution had become.
All that rubbish, if China bans the imports of waste.
China launched an aggressive anti-pollution push, cracking down on what it calls foreign garbage.
China has introduced a ban on recycling many types of plastic waste from abroad to try to reduce pollution.
On July 18, 2017, China announced that they were going to effectively ban imports of plastic scrap and severely limit most other recyclables. They were finished serving as the recycling bin to the world.
Okay, so, I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, but that's about the same time frame when they stopped picking up recycling in front of my house every week. So how much of my recycling is going over to China? I mean, I don't know for sure. There's no direct information that I have, but it seems that most of our recycling has been sent overseas. And then this video goes on to show the fallout of that, you know. Plastic building up at ports and it has nowhere to go. People starting to burn plastic. And then Malaysia starts taking the plastic that was going to China, and suddenly the entire country of Malaysia is just like covered in plastic. And there's shots in this episode of just piles of plastic everywhere in neighborhoods and in streets. You know, so it essentially becomes the poor suffering while the rich recyclers in the country are profiting off of this. And this is our trash. So it's absolutely an environmental social justice issue. Now, the other thing with microplastics relates more closely to my job. So there's a big, we talked about the macroplastics, what's going on with those. Now there's all these microplastics that you've heard of, probably heard of starting back in the mid-2000s when all these plastic beads were found to be in soaps, and they were all washing, you know, we'd wash them into our into the sewers, and then they're getting out into the rivers and eventually landing in the Great Lakes. So there's all these microplastic beads in the Great Lakes. Well, they got that banned pretty quickly. Can't actually produce soaps or other cosmetics with the plastic beads anymore. But that's not the only issue. So in the last several years, they've been finding a whole host of other of these microplastics. And we took this on in my organization. I have a couple more videos of you that just give a good overview of what exactly microplastics are. So we're going to talk about that.
Plastics have been a significant source of pollution for decades. Of course, recycling is great. We need to reuse what we can. But it doesn't address the problem of microplastics. Microplastics are the tiny, mostly unseen particles that enter our environment due to the way plastics, such as polyester, break down. These fragments are so tiny that when they enter our water system, they don't get filtered out during the water treatment process. And thus, they enter our environment. The Huron River is the largest source of microplastic pollution in the Great Lakes chain. And since it's in our rivers and lakes, it's in what we eat and drink. If we all take action, we can drastically reduce the output of microplastics into the Huron River.
All right. Oops. We're going to do one more. Is this the next slide? We'll see. Yes, this is different.
Microplastics are tiny particles of plastic that pollute our local waterways, even the Huron River. Microfibers from synthetic clothes and blankets are the biggest source of microplastic pollution in the Huron River. Wash these items less. And wear more natural fibers, such as cotton. You can also learn more about finding ways to catch the plastic during the wash process. And contact your favorite clothing manufacturers to find out what they are doing about microplastic fibers. There are lots of other ways you can help. For example, store your water in reusable bottles or cups. Ask your favorite takeout restaurant to use compostable containers. Bring your own shopping bags to the store. Volunteer your time to help clean our environment. And let your local politicians know that this is an issue that you care about. If we all take action, we can drastically reduce the output of microplastics into the Huron River.
Okay. So beyond the videos, here's just some fast facts about microplastics. They're in dust, you know, so everywhere around us there's little bits of plastic floating around. We consume a credit card worth of plastic every week because it's definitely getting into our food supply. We're drinking it, 100% sure of that because I've seen that. I'll show you. Microplastics are found in every stool sample from people in 8 countries around the world. What exactly do they do to us? Well, that's not as well known right now. All the effort so far has been on monitoring, trying to understand how much where it's coming from, and this is a very recent issue. So it's going to take more effort from the public health domain to understand like what exactly these microplastics are doing to us. But there's some theories, obstruction, not so much for humans, but for some of our smallest microorganisms or insects that are forming the base of our food chain. We see microplastics can just physically block digestive systems and cause death. Microplastics have been called toxic rafts, which is kind of an interesting term. Basically, these things out in the river are almost like sponges for other pollutants, PFAS, pesticides. So it's like absorbing these other materials, heavy metals, and then, you know, so then you end up with something that's really nasty. So it may not necessarily be the plastic itself, but it may be these other materials glomming onto the plastics. Plastics are, you know, and we talked about this already, known endocrine disruptors. So causing things like infertility and just a host of other issues. And then, as mentioned, this is when I started paying attention to the issue. The USGS The United States Geological Survey said the Huron River had the highest microplastic count of the major Great Lake tributaries. So that's when our organization wanted to look into it a little bit more. And I wanted to look into it more. This was an interesting issue to me, and I monitor water for a living. So this is the Huron River watershed. Here we are in Ann Arbor. The Huron River goes down to Lake Erie. It starts up in Oakland County. It flows right by some major towns. It goes right by Dexter, or right by Brighton. It goes right by Dexter. It goes through Ann Arbor, through Ypsilanti. Where is the plastic coming from in this whole stretch? So what I did was I sampled every major tributary coming into the river, as well as on the river itself, to understand where is this plastic coming from. So that's me in the river there, the net we built. Basically, we would allow 1,000 gallons of water to go through this net, and we'd collect it on the back end. That would get put through a filter, and then my interns did a lot of the work, and then I took it up after they were done for the summer. Actually going through stuff that looks like that, cell by cell, and counting the number of little microplastics that we found. So very tedious work. I'm still not done. Like it takes me a day or something to go through a filter. Just like really, really time consuming. So this is just an example of a sample. Most of the stuff you're seeing, that's algae and little bits of debris and leaves and whatnot. This would be a creek that just has a lot more sediment in it. So this one's easy. I could do this in a couple hours. But when you get something like this and you're looking at it under a microscope, you have to consider if each particle of sand is actually a microplastic. And so it's a real pain, as you can imagine. So that's mostly sand and muck and dirt. But then that's what a microplastic fiber actually looks like. So it's less, this one particular one, less than a millimeter long. It almost always has this bluish color.
Which is the microplastic?
The long skin.
The long blue thingy here. So people always see that and says, well, is it because we're in Michigan and that's why all your microplastics are blue? And it's like, everyone's wearing blue fleece. Is that the reason? And it's like, no, I think this is a universal thing. They always are either a bluish or a reddish color. And I think it has to do with that toxic raft issue where it's pulling in this other stuff, and that tends to dye it blue. Here's another one. These microplastic fibers often look like little Christmas ribbons, so they're twisting on themselves. Here's one wrapped around a bunch of rocks. We have both a blue and a reddish microfiber in there. Here's another one that's twisted and frayed. It has more of a fishing line appearance. It's very long and twisting around, but I think it was too small to actually be fishing line, so I'm not sure what that was. But it was plastic. You don't always find fibers, even though fibers like that you just saw, that's about 90% of what we'll find. But sometimes we'll find flakes. You know, that would be called a fragment. And that's really small. That's 0.13 millimeters. This is like a piece of a tarp. So that got pulled out of the river, quite large. Not even technically a microplastic, actually, but it made it through our filters. Once in a while, we find a bead. So they're still out there, but there's not as many. I think maybe twice in an entire summer sampling, we pulled out a microplastic bead. There's just another really long, twisting one. So I'm not done yet. This is taking forever, and it's an unfunded project, so I've actually been pulled to other things. And I'm not done yet, but with the samples I have gone through, this is what I've found. Just the dots represent the relative abundance. Down here, this creek with the biggest dot is that Swift Run Creek. kind of running by, oh, it's like over by Carpenter Road area. And then this big one right here, that's Miller's Creek, that runs right alongside Huron Parkway from Gallup Park up to like the Georgetown area. So that's and then a few other spots throughout the watershed, but it seems like the majority of them might be coming from the Ann Arbor area specifically. But there's one of my conclusions, well, not really conclusions, tentative hypothesis, I guess. Everyone's saying in the literature that microplastics are coming from laundry, but laundry should be going through the sanitary system, so going through treatment processes. The treatment processes certainly aren't designed to take out microplastics. That's just not something they've even considered. But this creek and this creek, where it's the highest, that's 100% a sewered system. There shouldn't really be any leakage from the sewers directly into the creeks. So where exactly are they? Shouldn't that plastic should not be coming from the sewers? So where exactly is it coming from? And I don't know. So it's more than just fleece. It's more than just washing fleece, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's coming from other sources that we don't really even know about yet. Because this plastic should be, if it was just fleece, it should be going through the wastewater treatment plant and wouldn't get released till right about there. Right, that's actually where the most should be coming in, and it's not even that high right there. So the literature isn't satisfying to me yet of what I've found. Well, here's a better zoomed up version. I forgot I had that. So the Ann Arbor's wastewater treatment plant is actually like right here, right? So that's where we should expect to, if all this stuff was coming out of laundry, this is where we should expect to see the highest numbers, and we're not. One issue I had was, okay, I need to figure out how to clean my equipment, and I don't want to contaminate it with microplastics as I'm trying to clean it, because that would ruin the experiment. So how do I clean it? And this is when I was really, when I discovered something that really made me nervous. The water I was regularly drinking every day at work is actually this one. So I just ran pure drinking water through my filters to make sure that I could use that water to clean my equipment. And I realized very quickly I couldn't. I only did a couple of counts because this really wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. So it's a very low sample size. But I discovered just in two samples, and this is only 2 liters of water, I was coming up with 27, 16 pieces of microplastic in the water that I'm regularly drinking. So that made me say, okay, well, how much in other locations? So basically everywhere I'd find at least some microplastics. I have some friend's house. This is on the Ann Arbor water system. It was much better than what I was drinking at work. 2 liters of bottled Kroger water had microplastics in it. So. If you search microplastics in water, microplastics in beer, you'll find all kinds of interesting articles. There was a study done that showed 12 brands of beer from the Great Lakes area all had microplastics in them. So this gets back to what I was saying, that we consume about a credit card worth on a weekly basis. So initial takeaways from my microplastics work. Yes. There's tons of microplastics out there. We're consuming it. I accidentally discovered that they're more concentrated in our drinking water than our river water by a factor of somewhere between 100 and 500 times. There's just a lot of variation. It's heavily controlled by the weather. So it's really kind of a messy study. It's not ready for publication or anything. I don't know if it ever will be. This is a very difficult thing to try to piece together. So, gonna just run through some conclusions here. With all that in mind, you know, environmentalists kind of like live to depress people. It's like what we do. So it's like it's never, you never want to leave it there, right? So So will we be earth keepers when it comes to this plastic issue? When we use plastic, are we lowering the earth's fruitfulness? Can we give the earth a plastic Sabbath? That sounds like a great band, right? Plastic Sabbath. And it seems very overwhelming, like we can't possibly do anything about this. But I think we already have. I mean, think of us as a collective group. We're making a bigger difference together, and we're not certainly not the only people doing this. I think more and more people are becoming aware of some of these issues, especially with China closing down their imports. I think a lot of people woke up to say, whoa, I didn't even know my trash was going to China. We've already moved away from single-use plastic at our potlucks and our pizza nights. I've kind of been watching this, and we used to certainly fill up one of those big trash cans at every one of these, maybe more. And at this point, at least at pizza night, what we have is a small layer of plastic, and most of it's in the compost bin. So like we're making a difference together, which I think is great. What else can you do? First of all, I think it's important to recognize that it's in our culture, in our civilization, unless you're willing to like live in the woods by yourself, it's nearly impossible to give up plastic entirely, so don't hold yourself to that standard. Don't let that just cause you to give up. We don't need perfection. What we need is people to just start thinking and teaching others. Little changes. If you can make a little change this year and a little change next year, it'll already be better than 90% of people out there. If you drink from single-use plastic bottles, you stop doing that. You think you might be recycling them, but a lot of them are just getting burned or just make going to a landfill anyway. And also, there's just health risks with that. There's probably more microplastics in watered bottle, and there's certainly more chemicals in bottled water. So drink from aluminum cans if you still need that fizzy special drink. Aluminum cans are far more likely to get recycled than reused. This is an interesting one. Straws are one of those top things on beach cleanups. So before someone gives you a straw, tell them not to give you the straw. If you wait till after they put it on the table, it's already done. Like, they're going to throw it away. So at the restaurant, address the issue before they even have a chance to give you a straw. A lot of people do this already, use reusable bags at the grocery store, but use them beyond the grocery store. Bring them into Target, bring them into Walgreens, you know, these other places where maybe your mind isn't thinking reusable grocery bags. Because you're used to doing those at the grocery store. Stop buying polar fleece. This is a great fabric, and I love it so much, and I have a bunch of them before I knew all this stuff with microfibers. Now I'm not so excited about them anymore. What I do have, I try to minimize the washing of, because that's really where the impacts come from. Pay attention to new products that are made to minimize sloughing. So Patagonia, REI, or consumer-conscious, environmentally conscious companies, I know they're actively researching fleece to make it better and slough less. So in the future, I'm not saying stop forever, but in the future, there's going to be new materials that are better that you can buy a little more guilt-free. So here's the advanced version. So you already do all of that, and you want to do more. We got these bamboo utensils, and Ben was so excited to get his own set. I don't know where he's going to carry it since he doesn't have a purse or a car. But we now try to keep, Kelly has a set in her purse, which she just bought me a set. I'm going to try to keep it in my car. You never know where you're going to go somewhere. It's going to force you to use plastic utensils. That's all they have. Like, we just went to a new restaurant, and they had plastic utensils there, and we had no idea walking in that was going to be the case. So get your own utensils. I think it's also important to understand that plastic goes beyond individual responsibility. The plastic industry, if you watch that Broken video, they'll explain it very well. They've done a very good job of deflecting responsibility away from them and onto the consumer. Like, this is an individual problem. You individuals, it's your job to recycle, right? But no, they're actually the ones who started the recycling thing to try to deflect. Like, they're the ones who came up with the whole idea. But it's a corporate responsibility, and we need to hold companies responsible. So do these things. Like, when you go to a restaurant and you feel like they're really using a lot of plastic and it's just immediately going into the trash, well, when that manager walks by you and asks how you're doing, well, actually tell them, you know, I'd really prefer if you'd use compostable materials or stop using so much plastic. And then I just can't recommend this book enough. This is the one written for England, but it's very relevant for us. And it gives very practical tips for how to get rid of plastic in all areas of your life. Toothbrushes. Bill just gave me a bamboo toothbrush, so I'm looking forward to trying that. You know, there's all kinds of alternative materials if you just research it and think about it. To stop using so much plastic. So, that's my presentation. Chris.
I want to bang the drum on number six again. The petrochemical industry, and I watched the same program, I think I mentioned
it. You told me about it.
It was astonishing to me, the revelation of the profit that they make and the drop in the bucket that they contributed to do curbside recycling. It's a really cynical gesture from a group of people who make a ton of money creating a problem that's going to plague us for generations. We need to shut that down.
What was the name of the company?
It's all of them. Anyone makes plastic bags or plastic containers or single-use products are part of the problem. And what they've done, as Paul mentioned, is they've said, it's really a recycling problem. If you just do your part and you contribute, and we're going to put these bins at your street, and we're going to make it even easier, single-stream recycling, it's this panacea. There are only three plastics they actually recycle. Number five, polypropylene, which is probably the easiest to recycle, because its makeup makes it possible to recycle again and again without degradation. And then one and two, which degrade over time, and typically when you look at those things, they end up in the waste stream, and in these poorer countries, they're literally putting black clouds in the air, and the communities who live downwind from them are experiencing all kinds of health problems, respiratory problems, reproductive problems, digestive problems, and it's unfortunately it's part of this waste stream that was created by the petrochemical industry. We know a lot more. Maybe everyone was naive at the beginning. We know a lot more now. And I think they need to be held to account. And I love the ideas of reducing consumption, because if they can't sell it, they're going to stop producing it in the quantities. But we need to help them shut it down. It's just really, really bad for all of us.
Thanks, Chris. We should break, but feel free to leave. But we can talk more for those who want to we want to stay, but pick up kids at Sunday school, and church starts in 50 minutes, but yeah.
Oh, I was curious, in your water tests, did you ever test raw water?
No, I always meant to, and I kept on forgetting, but yeah, well water, it's on my to-do list, so like, well water should be good, I would imagine it should be good. It's had so much depth of soils to go through and filter and bacteria to process that I would think it should be fine. I do want to know more about well water. Teresa.
Can I ask you other things that we can do for that list?
Sure, go ahead.
One is to get politically active with the Clean Water Action Group. Every year they come to your door, and you can donate, you can be aware of the issues and how they're cleaning up the Huron River, and letters you can write to protect the Clean Water Act that could potentially be overturned, holding industry accountable to dumping in the river. So political action. The second one is to buy better soaps. I just actually found one yesterday, so I've been gradually getting better. Organic, GMO, non-phthalates, non-parabens, but I found the best one. I was like, I want to get biodegradable soap.
Yeah.
Because I'm like seeing the stuff floating in my bath still. So Soapworks is sold at Plum Market, Arbor Farms. And you get a big jug, and it's hand soap, shampoo, any kind of soap, and then they have bar soap, and they're all biodegradable. Laundry soap, biodegradable. So you're not, so there's no plastics, no chemicals, no nothing. So just getting a whole picture that way.
Yeah, and I think it's important to just recognize, like, it's a slow process. Like, you're learning as you go, and it's not like I'm expecting everyone to just become champions today, right? Like, if you can just do one or two things initially and you work your way to what Teresa's talking about, I mean, I think that's the way to do it and not get overwhelmed. Just slowly make it part of your life.
Yeah.
Also, alternatives to bleach. BioClean is one of the best products for alternatives to bleach. Just to get away from that.
All right, thanks everybody for coming.
Thanks for your work.
Being a good audience. Did it go to sleep after 30 seconds?